Hey, my name's Teddy Bear, 1975. This is Special Owner, Grinding Triple. Huffdale, 3274.
Talking to him about this, and I was surprised that we even needed that bill, because the law permits, in time of dissolution of the marriage, the restoration of the previous name. But she indicated that there are courts that, notwithstanding the fact that the petitioner or the respondent, a female, asked for the name change, the courts have denied it. Is that the way you understand it?
That's what I understand, Senator Carson, and I also did have some difficulty with Willamette in persuading them to issue me a contract in my own name rather than my husband's name. I had a 1950 Attorney General's opinion cited to me, and I simply argued hard and successful in the end, but I had to fight for it.
How does... Well, actually, Section 3 is the one you're talking about. Upon entering marriage, either person may retain the prior term.
Okay. That is a change from... Well, it's a change from the way some people interpret the common law. More and more women have been doing this, although I think it's not terribly common yet. Various others have easy time or hard time.
How do I refer to you and your husband when I write a letter to you? What's the appropriate?
Then call me in Claudia Burton.
What if I want to use Mr... Is it Mrs. Claudia Burton? Ms. Claudia Burton?
I use MS in writing and Miss in oral. MS sounded so ugly to me.
Ms. You don't like the way? Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don, what are you doing?
I'm here on Kendall 536 in
You had a chance to talk to Don about that human resources thing?
Yes, I'm going to make a run at it this morning. I don't know. I'm going to try and get it back up here. The only thing that Don and I felt that it probably ought to go to rest permanently, but I don't think we thought we might bring it up here if they're determined to single out drugs in some particular area. It would probably be best not to put it into burglary, but to put it into theft. If we want to enhance, as they say, the penalty, right?
Yeah.
I think he and I would be inclined to bring it back and let it sleep here for the rest of the session, but I think in fairness to the other committee, I'd have to mention it, so we'll have to run at it and see if we can get back up.
Don Flynn, Assistant Attorney General. I'm here just as an individual capacity, however. Mr. Gillette and I have talked about Senate Bill 536 yesterday. I'm not here to support the bill as it's written. I am here, however, to recommend a compromise, which I think would accomplish essentially what this bill is attempting to do, and that is to make the penalty, particularly for your more serious assault, correspond more closely to the gravity of the offense. And if I could, just to refresh your recollection about the assault laws as we have them and as they were written and enacted in the 1971 Criminal Code Revision. We have three degrees of assault, basically broken down into in an ascending manner. With respect to the nature of the motivation behind the assault or the culpability or the type of weapon used, if there is a weapon, or if there is any physical injury. Of course, assault contemplates physical injury even in the lower degrees of assault, and we have defined in the code physical injury and also serious physical injury. I think Mr. Gillette has informed members of the committee about some of the problems the district attorneys have run into with this concept. And the basic concept and the rationale behind what we did with assault was to look at assault as a substantive offense in and of itself and not an incompleted battery. And I think that we had a good idea. I think it's still a good idea. I think where we missed the boat, however, was when it came time to classify the offense into a category of a misdemeanor or a felony. Not only to fit the penalty to these particular crimes, but also to have some rationality between the penalties for assault, particularly when you have a high degree of culpability, an intentional or knowing kind of assault that results in serious injury, or one that involves the use of a deadly or dangerous weapon. Now, throughout the criminal code, the more serious form of crime involving threat or actual injury to persons were looked upon, I think appropriately so, as the more serious ones, and the kind of crimes that from a criminal code standpoint that we could distinguish from other crimes, such as property crimes or other crimes involving or not involving any injury or threat to the safety of other persons. And you'll find throughout the criminal code now such crimes as burglary in the first degree, classified as Class A felony, rape in the first degree, Class A felony, deed of sexual intercourse, first degree, Class A felony, kidnapping, first degree, Class A, first degree robbery, Class A felony, right down the line. I think to cut this short now, I guess, it would be to say that my recommendation would be, and one that I have made in the past, not only to the legislature in 1971 and the Senate Criminal Law Committee, and also in the 73 session to the House Judiciary Committee, and also the Criminal Law Revision Commission when we were working on this particular article, is that the assault in the first degree should be classified as a Class A felony. Assault in the second degree should be a Class B felony.
Wait, hold on. I didn't get with that. So it's start over on the penalties, please?
Yes. Assault in the first degree, and that appears, of course, on page 3 of the bill, that's ORS 163.185, which is now a Class B felony, and which, as this bill is drafted, would not change, would be my recommendation that statute be amended in subsection 2 to reclassify it from a Class B felony to a Class A felony. And then up
the line. Well, now, would you restore that serious?
Yes, I would otherwise leave the statute just the way it appears, not in the bill, but it appears on the book. Yes, I think.
And the median lines 22 and 23?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And then on up above section 2, beginning on line 5, page 3, ORS 163.175, assault in the second degree, on lines 8 through 10, I would restore the original language. Delete the and restore the language on lines 11 and 12, and then delete the amendment that appears on line 13. Then on line 50, amend the bill so that assault in the second degree would become a Class B felony rather than a Class C felony. Now, with respect to assault in the third degree, which I don't think is set forth in the bill, but it is not a Class A misdemeanor, and I think that without hurting the overall concept, I don't feel all that strong about it personally, because I don't think in the long run it's going to make that much difference if these other two are graded accordingly. But assault in third degree, which was really meant to replace the old assault and battery kind of statute, the misdemeanor kind, which now involves physical injury to another done intentionally or knowingly or recklessly, or physical injury with done criminally negligently by means of a deadly weapon. That contemplates such as negligently wounding another or something like that with a firearm. That's the Class A misdemeanor now. Supposed to be consistent, that could be reclassified to make it a Class B felony. Maybe Joette has some views on that, but I think what we're trying to get at here, and I think that the difficulty that prosecutors have had with this, is that in view of the ways that the courts have construed the term serious physical injury, that we've had some rather weird results, or an unfortunate result, that have caused I think some misuse of what the assault provision contemplated, and that is to have the gravity of the penalty fit the gravity of the assault. And I think that if these were reclassified, see, then even if you were able to prove only an attempt, and that was another important thing we were contemplating when we wrote these assault provisions, and that was to eliminate quite a number of old statutes. There used to be assault with intent to rob, intent to commit rape, intent to kill, assault armed with a dangerous weapon, and in fact there were a couple on that. Assault, robbery or theft while not armed, assault with a deadly weapon, assault while unarmed by means of force, and all these different types of assault. And we meant that those then would be treated as attempted assault if an assault did not actually culminate in some physical injury to the victim, that those would be prosecuted as attempts. Now, the penalty for an attempt is one step lower than the completed substantive offense, which means then that if you're prosecuting for assault in the first degree under the proposed change to a Class A felony, if you proved an attempt, you would be in the ballpark of a Class B felony. Also, in assault in the second degree, if it were Class B, then an attempt to commit such a crime would become a Class C felony. And I think that this would take care of maybe not all of the problems that Senate Bill 536 addresses, but I think substantially most.
What about the menacing and the fourth stage?
Well, I can't support those, and I don't think they're needed. I think that again, if your first two degrees of assault are classified A and B felony, then I just don't think the need for a degree of menacing as a Class B felony or a degree of recklessly endangering as a Class B felony is necessary. And more importantly, I think that as drafted and proposed by this bill, in effect, although they're called menacing in the first degree and recklessly endangering, they become much like the old crime of assault. I would expect with those, if those were adopted, that you just wouldn't have any prosecutions for assault in the second degree. I think that most prosecutors would do the same thing. It would be easier to prove menacing or recklessly endangering, so you go for that rather than assault. But I think recklessly endangering and menacing are important laws to have on the book, particularly where you don't have either an intent to hurt anybody or an intent to injure, or actually an injury that occurs, or where you're talking about reckless conduct that endangers somebody but hasn't actually harmed them.
Thank you. Any questions? We're done. Thank you very much. House Bill.
Does Mick want to speak to that,
Mr. Chairman? I didn't get here in time to sign up. I wonder if I might be allowed to say something about the bill.
Well, briefly, you've already testified on it once.
Well, in the first place, I want to indicate to me that I agree with John, that his proposal is much better than the bill. not very easy to say when you spent weeks drafting a bill. But I agree with him. I have, however, one significant disagreement, and that is with respect to the menacing and reckless danger. And I think there's a lot more merit to dividing those up between the types of weapons used and differentiating between felony and misdemeanor. However, the principal problem that prosecutors have would be solved by simply amending the subsidy of assault statute, as the matter suggested. We could even live with the gap between Class B and Class C, the gap between the Class B felony and the Class A misdemeanor. And if the committee were disposed to take that approach instead, drawing the amendments would be very easy. The point I want to bring to the committee's attention is that something needs doing. I came up with what I thought was a good solution. I think Don's point is a better one. And I wish that the original revision of the criminal code had taken that approach. Certainly an assault of the kind that Class A assault speaks to is at least as serious as rape or kidnapping or any of the other Class A felonies, and not to be treated as the same form. That's
the principle. Thank you. Let's get the bills. What bill are you at here?
275.
Okay. Would you like to come up, please? I'm sort of new today.
National Organization for Women, the Ivy Council for Women's Equality, the Ivy Women's Political Conference. In terms of the domicile bill, just briefly, I think it's a very important bill because, as Claudia Burton said, there are four groups of people who do not get to choose where they live: the trained people, married women, children, and military personnel. Three of those classifications, are military when it's temporary, but the whole idea of a married woman entering civil death upon marriage has always been, to me, very personally offensive. And it is the position of the Women's Rights Project that this is a bill which is definitely discriminatory upon sex, since it refers only to married women. And I feel very strongly that we should not make sex the determinant upon which a domicile is fixed. Going on now to name change.
Can I ask a question, Mr.
Sure.
Sandy, isn't this now a case law? And tradition and so on. I realize that that the effort is to perhaps get into statutes what already has been decided by some court.
Oregon case law, I guess.
Oregon case law is not there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Maureen Newberger certainly didn't take Justice Solomon's residence in Massachusetts when she was in the United States Senate. She remained an Oregon resident stayed in the Senate. And there are certainly many examples of that sort of thing.
It's been our experience in the unfortunate thing is that it varies very much depending on which judge you get and what mood the judge happens to be on that particular day. We're very concerned at the inconsistency of both.
Well, I know the name change. I've experienced that in court myself, in which the judge will sometimes allow the name change and sometimes won't. I guess it depends on whether or not I had a fight with wife that morning. But the domicile thing, I would certainly take Senator Brown's comment that if Oregon has not well established case law on it, then we ought to have that.
It's the opinion of Carol Hewitt, who is the chairperson of the Women's Rights Project, that the case law on it is not very shaky, at least not in this description. She deals with a lot very much called for, and she's done, quite frankly, much more research than I have. My reaction to it comes more on that level than having done research.
Well, now the bill then speaks to persons who may have different domiciles within the state, or may have a domicile. One may have a domicile in Oregon or another state. Anyway, in all sorts of conditions.
Sex, but sex will not be the determinant upon which that domicile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Going on to name change, then, it is the position of the Human Rights Project that all citizens, male or female, have the right to retain or change their name upon marriage, or to return to a previously used upon dissolution of marriage. This is one of the situations I think where women find themselves in a very awkward position, because it literally depends on which judge they get and what mood the judge is in on that day, whether or not they get their name back on their request. And very often that depends on the judge's personal subjective feelings on the question. It is our opinion that a woman who requests her name should have it promptly returned to her, and this bill would take care of that. We believe that the choice of surname is a very highly personal matter and of interest only to the people who must live with the consequences of it. As a married woman known by her birth name, I could cite all warning horror stories of things that have happened to me. U.S. Bank of America, I tried to tell me that I couldn't be bound in contract in any name but my husband, et cetera, ad nauseum. As you well know, common law decrees that any person may change his name at will so long as that change is not for fraudulent purposes. But the same common law has held that upon marriage, two people become one, that one is the husband, and the consequences were kind of a civil death for women. I did a little research on the question of children and found that under common law, there's nothing that says a child must be given his father's name or his mother's name. As a matter of fact, two people could give a child any set of names they wish. And therefore, I think that makes the argument of what name will the children have moot, because at this point, children can have any name the parents choose to give it anyway. And it's not uncommon where they are very mobile and more rapidly multi-monogamous society. People are changing marriages and taking children with them, and it's not uncommon to have children with more than one surname in their family. So it doesn't seem to me to be something that should hold bill up, because it's not the question of an adult woman having her own choice. Unfortunately, as I said, the customs surrounding name change are so ingrained in our culture that anybody who chooses at this point to buck the culture leaves themselves wide open for harassment, and this is why we feel the bill is so necessary. There's been many times when I would have given just about anything to be able to appoint to a specific statute and say, leave me alone, this is my right, and here's the law that says so. A clerk in the Multnomah County Elections Department refused to assist me applying for a passport once she found that my name was different from my husband. I had to go through the Seattle office in order to get a passport. So we feel the bill is necessary because it will place the choice of the name where it belongs upon the people who will be known by that name, and we urge that you will give this bill a rapid
question. Thank you very much. House Bill 2331, I can't read the witness's name.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, I'm Howard Bobbitt, Executive Secretary of the Board of Medical Examiners for the state of Oregon. House Bill 2331 was introduced in the House primarily for the purpose of a housekeeping bill. Now, I don't have before me the amendment. Unfortunately, this has been notified a night late, the bill was scheduled this morning. But the House did delete Section 3 on page 2 in the amendment. Now, you perhaps have those before you, do you?
Yes.
And, of course, under Section 1, the purpose of it, I think, is probably is the reason it's referred to judiciary. It was the question of the investigative and the procedural protection of the board, of the various administrative and other staff, and the protection of the informant concerning the any conduct of a licensure of the board. The other amendments that are proposed throughout the bill, and turning to them, over on page 4, the practice of a medicine by a duly qualified intern. Up till this time, an intern has never had any actual legal status in the practice of medicine, and this exempts, you might say, the practice or the internship. So it is actually named. It was a qualifying section for the licensure, but not they were not actually exempt or otherwise. Then upon page 4, the is a change of the examination of the board is given to the licensure of the for our fine for licensure. The flex examination is a federation licensing examination which is administered by the various state board organizations throughout the country, and it has an advantage over our bar examination to the effect that the same examination is given at the same time. It's a 3-day examination, and it's given at the same time throughout 48 of the 50 states. Undoubtedly, the other two states will come in to the and get true reciprocity, because a person can take the examination in New York and then be licensed in Oregon without any question. And medicine is different than law in the fact that normally your medical techniques apply nationwide and university rather than varying within the laws of the state. Another situation, an individual may take an examination in New York for Oregon, and New York Board will honor, or monitor for Oregon, so it doesn't mean that he has to come to Oregon. And it's necessary that this be in, because under the old statute, it was not a weighted examination. Under the flex examination, it is weighted. The first day, that deals with your basic sciences of medicine, is given 1 point. The second day, which is your clinical sciences, is given 2 points. The third day, which is your clinical competence, is given 3 points. And they're all then total and divided by 6, and then this gives the average of the 75, which is required for passing. And it is a medicine field. Of course, the clinical competence is more important than knowing the anatomy, because you can always look for this. Then turning over in the on page 8, the change there is merely a word change. In other words, upon edit, the formerly the statute as a ground for revocation was changing of a location. Well, actually, it was meant to be the failure to report a change to an address. Upon the same page, there's a provision refuses, where the board proposes to refuse to issue a license or refuses to restore an inactive registrant to active registration. That individual then will have an opportunity for a hearing, which is not in the present time. Then, on page 9, a provision is placed within the Act, which again was an omission in the original Revocation Act, in which the board is given the power to administer oaths, issues, notices, and subpoenas, the name of the board, and enforce the subpoenas, as a matter authorized by ORS 183440. The board has historically had the right to issue the subpoenas. In the present Act, we have the right to go to the court to have them enforced, but the selling out of the actual power to issue the board was not placed within it. The one other point which may come up, it's not in the bill here, and just the fact that they started to notice, I haven't had a chance to talk with Representative Ferguson, but in the under 2741, which is your malpractice bill, which I'm sure you all 2741. now, which you all are familiar with. Budget Committee asked about the impact upon that on the board, and I've submitted a letter to the budget which indicates that with that and possibly emergency technicians, there's probably, I imagine, around about $40,000 a year that we're going to have to expand to enforce this. And I suggested to Lieutenant Ferguson that they possibly change our annual registration, active registration for the doctors from $25 to $35. I frankly do not know where that is. He indicated that he might try to put his amendment went back to the Senate from here. That would give us about $80,000 in the biennium, and we, our estimated cost in this is about $78,220 to enforce it. I think it's the practical time to put it through. Actually, the Board of Medical Examiners does have a surplus, and it would not be, would just be taken from the surplus now, and that they then have to ask for it 3 years from now. The Oregon Medical Association has no objection to this increase. Actually, the doctors, MDs and DOs at $25 are the lowest active licentiate in the scale of the healing arts at present time.
Question. Thank you very much, sir. Representative Bailey, what bill are you here on?
I'm here for the 3274 and 3274. I'd like to say a word on 3274. Sure. I'm Nancy Gray, the state representative of Wayne County, and I would just like to encourage you, questions about whether or not it's necessary. It is a bill of probably greater symbolic importance than otherwise, because guys. The common law idea that this girl is trying to leave the town, we did not make decisions of our own, and something that's great symbolic importance to us. But also, there seems to be an effective question. It does cause a problem. Maybe it's because a woman doesn't know her rights, maybe she doesn't know that, and that she had a lawyer to sign up on her as to see what she would be able to have her own domicile. But why should she have to go to the trouble of proving that she can see their home when a man doesn't have to? The Attorney General was asked for an opinion. This was in 1970, and as I recall, it was a girl who in a very prominent Oregon family who married someone from out of state and was told she had to pay out of state tuition from that point on. She had to pay in state tuition. And the Attorney General, the question was, may an institution state that the higher education require a female resident of Oregon to pay non-resident tuition subsequent to a marriage to a non-resident? And the answer was yes. The state board had changed the rule. They tell me that we're clean on this one. This girl obviously is an estate that we do not wait her to out of state within a time, although we continually run into cases where a girl has to prove it. And some of them may not just not go through the proving of it. They said the state board has changed its rules there now, but we still have this opinion that says that they can. I think that's something to consider. It appears, as kind of Kathleen would say, we went down the way where it was probably come up, and we see us with the domicile being important as far as where the states are administered.
Thank you very much, Representative Jones. What bill are you hearing? 2626. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Representative Jones, representing District 60. I'm here. testify on House Bill 2626. The original statute here gives the counties the right to condemn water courses and water and for riparian rights. And when I'm running through some bills last session, I run onto this, and that particular language kind of got me concerned when I noticed that riparian rights. And so I attempted to just remove that part, and I only intended for it to apply to the vested rights. However, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, had some objections to just removing that particular part from the statute on account of maybe they might want to create some drain ditches or something of that nature. So, at my request, the amendments were prepared, and it just simply says that the county's right to condemn or otherwise affect or impair our vested rights. It just eliminates the state's or county's right to condemn vested rights, which are our water rights that date from 1909 back. And of course, my fear was there that someday maybe in the fight for more water, like to send to California or some other public use, that would impair our vested rights, which we need to exist in all parts of Oregon where we're dependent upon irrigation water. And this is all, that's all that this particular bill applies to, is our vested rights.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.